This episode is brought to you by North Texas Honda Dealers. North Texas Honda Dealers, they're here to help.
He has time, launches it to the end zone. Touchdown, Terrence Williams!
The throw goes to the right side for Crabtree. It's caught. He's the worst ever!
Puts up the 10, puts it up the right sideline!
Yeah, he's got to go, he's tackled. Sam Houston wins it. The Bearcats capture their first FCS champion.
Hello and welcome to the Republic of Football. I'm your host, the college editor here at Texas Football, Ishmael Johnson, here in his lovely abode, fresh off seeing the Moody Center in person again. Mike Craven. Mike, how you doing?
Doing pretty good. Those horns are good when I'm in attendance. I've seen Gonzaga and Iowa State game, both really impressive performances by Texas. I hope Rodney Terry keeps that job. He's got it rocking there.
That's been an interesting point of discussion. Me and Bruni over on Zone Star State have been trying to figure out what Chris Del Conte is looking for, right, when it comes to like splashy hire versus the guy that's kind of just getting it done. So that's gonna be something to watch. And of course, on the other line, Mallory Hartley, Mike-less, but still here with us, or at least a professional Mike-less, but here with us still. How you doing, Mallory?
I'm doing well. I'm just kicking it with the old school's computer audio. So if I sound
the built-in mic. Craven,
I have a question for you. Is the Moody Center probably the best basketball arena, college basketball arena that you've been to? I've always wanted to go, but I obviously am never really in Austin, so I've never had the opportunity to get over there.
I think what's nice about the Moody Center is you compare it to the Irwin Center. You know, and so like the Irwin Center in Austin, it was outdated. It had been open since I think the 50s or 60s.
Right.
The acoustics were bad. It always felt empty, even if there was 12,000 people in there, just because of how big and cavernous it is. What's nice about the Moody Center, and I think it's true for like the Fertitta Center in Houston, TCU has a really cool basketball stadium, Texas Tech as well, where it's like with 10,000 people, it's full and it's packed and it's sold out and it's loud, right, and everybody's on top of you. So I think they did a good job of getting the fans closer to the action. And I think most basketball stadiums that have been built in the last, 10, 15 years have that same type of model. And it really helps the atmosphere of the game for sure.
Yeah.
Every home game I've seen for Texas just feels different, right? It feels like they're playing some, because I'm so used to the Irwin Center like you, it feels like it's some being played somewhere else. Where it's like, is this Tech? Is this Duke? You know, like it just feels that type of atmosphere. So I'll have to make my way there eventually. All right. I don't know how to transition, but we had one piece of kind of interesting news drop earlier this week. Ross Dellinger, we're gonna get right into this part. Ross Dellinger, Sports Illustrated, had a report that college football executives are looking over four potential rule changes. He didn't confirm that they're going to be looking into all of these or implementing a couple. But long story short, college football executives think the game is too long and they are trying to shorten game times. They're looking into two quote unquote minor rules and two quote unquote major rules to help change. The rules that they're looking at are banning consecutive timeouts, which in this case would more affect icing kickers. Usually that's when that's implemented. No more untimed downs to end the first and third quarter from defensive penalties. Of course, that's not really the reason why those are minor is because those don't come up that often. So it feels like maybe a thing just to get rid of without causing much harm. The two major rule changes, which are the ones that kind of caused most interesting discussion on Twitter, continuing to run the clock after first downs, except for inside 2 minutes of either half. That'll be obviously changed a huge dynamic of college football. And then, of course, the last one is running the clock following an incomplete pass once the ball is spotted by the referee for the next down. So the one interesting Craven, first, I'll get your thoughts on this. Of course, I put up a small little piece on Ross's report at textfootball.com. You can go read his full report, of course, on Sports Illustrated. He goes into detail about getting some opinions on it, things like that. By the way, quick hint for Corey Hogue. He has a piece coming up tomorrow, recording on Wednesday. He has a piece coming up on Division III head coaches sounding off on these potential rule changes because they don't have an issue of game speed being or games being too long. They don't have media timeouts. They don't have things like that, but this is a rule that would theoretically still impact them as well. So he'll have a piece kind of where he talks to some coaches about what they think about these rule changes. Mike, what were your thoughts when you first saw this?
I think this conversation comes down to two points. The first is, are college football games too long, right? Like, mm-hmm. it starts there. Like, I think for me, as somebody who covers the game, I'm fine with the length of games. I'm there for 7 hours regardless. So if I'm tuning into a football game, I'm not watching the clock and going, well, if this doesn't finish in 15 minutes, I'm done. Or you know, if it's a good game, it's a good game. So I don't know how much of that the viewing public is actually craving. However, I do understand the idea of maybe there's too many plays in a game, right? Mm-hmm. And we can eliminate both of those problems at the same time. Let's shorten the window so we're not taking up 4 or 5 hours so we can get more games on TV. And then also, let's shorten those games because players are playing 90 snaps a game on defense, and that's really probably not the healthiest thing in the world. I mean, we could argue that 70 plays a game probably isn't the healthiest thing in the world. But I went back and looked at just Texas Tech stats, for example. They were running 76.5 plays in the year 2000, and that was with 614 passing plays a game. So it's not like they weren't passing the ball back then, right? And so this year, they ran 91 plays per game. So it was 15 more plays a game this year than back in 2000. And that's with throwing the ball fewer times. And so, you know, I think we've just gotten to a point where not only are there more passing offenses, but there's more up-tempo offenses. Mm-hmm. And the amount of space in between plays is also shortening. And these TV execs, the NCAA board, are trying to eliminate a lot of problems at once. How can we get players to play fewer, you know, snaps? How can we increase the time in between those snaps? And how can we fit this game into a shorter window so we can get as many products in front of the viewers as we can throughout the weekend? And so for me, the amount of plays per game is probably the issue that needs to be addressed more than the amount of time per game. But maybe those issues are so together that by helping one, you help the other.
Yeah. I think one of the other issues that spawn this, or I guess, I don't know. One topic I saw brought up was the media timeout, right? That's kind of a thing that's kind of lengthening. That's something that I don't know how much that can help because those are the people giving money to the NCAA. So it's not like they can like, well, actually we're not going to run commercials anymore, but like, you know, I don't know if it's more prominent in the NFL, but you get the extra point time or extra point commercial, kickoff commercial, right? That thing happens, right? And that's like 15 minutes right there. But that extends games, right? And I wonder if there's a way to, I mean, me and you are both wrestling fans. AEW does the picture in picture, right? Where it's like, if you want to chop off, in my opinion, legitimately probably 20 minutes of a game, how about we don't cut to commercial after a kickoff? Right. And we just kind of keep that. We can add the commercial, right? Yeah, sure. It'll be the big thing playing. And then it maybe minimizes and goes to some type of picture in picture where the game's still going on. Because, yeah, I think when you're covering the game, at least for me, when Texas State started being on TV more and started being broadcasted more, you don't realize, like, when you're there and you're not on TV, you don't realize how much the game stops if you're not used to being there. Right. You see the guy with the orange sleeve on and you're out there and you're like, what's that? Oh, right. They're just at commercial right now. And it's like, it does kind of take, unless you're used to that, right? Unless you go to Texas games, if you go to games that are on ESPN, now obviously all of them are usually on some type of platform. You're used to that now, but if you're D2, FCS, things like that, you're not used to seeing that guy just kind of halting play and you're like, well, what's going on? The other thing that I thought was very interesting is what happens to the spiked ball if the last one is implemented, right? Running clock, following an incomplete pass once the ball is spotted. What happens to spiking the ball?
That,
I would think that they would have to implement a up to the 2 minute rule as the same as the continuing the running clock after a first down thing where there's an amendment to like in the final 2 minutes, it does stop. Cause you're right. That would change strategy completely. And you can't change strategy based on rule changes, right? I'm all for changing some rules as long as it doesn't mess with what football is at its core. Right. And like the 2 minute drill is a big part of what football is at its core. I'm with you. There's a way to, you know, picture in picture some of these commercials. And then the one, and maybe I'm on an island here, the one I think is the most obvious is just shortening halftime. Like, who are we doing this for anymore, right? Like, nobody cares about halftime. Like, we're all just getting drinks and going to the bathroom and stuff like that. It doesn't need to be 25, 30 minutes, whatever college halftime is. Make it like the NFL halftime, and there's 10 minutes right there.
And I think that brings up another good point too. I think the rules 1 through 3 that they're trying to change mirrors the NFL a lot. But that last rule that has brought up a lot of controversy, you know, keeping the clock running even after an incomplete pass, that doesn't really follow what the NFL looks like right now. So, I mean, why?
Yeah, I don't like that one. I don't like the running
keep clock. That, yeah, that one just doesn't really makes it. It's kind of that outlier to me a little bit.
And I should hint at Ross Dellinger did say that was more of the drastic. Like that's the last, that is, it's lumped in right with the others, but he said that is like the last one that they're looking at implementing. He also goes on to say, and again, you'll hear more from Corey Hoag's piece Thursday morning when it goes up, you know, that it's unclear how much this affects D2, D3, because mm-hmm. they acknowledge that this is an FBS problem, right? FCS will most certainly be impacted because it all falls under the Division I banner. But right now there is no... there's no indication that it wouldn't impact D2, D3. So theoretically, this would be an umbrella change at that level, which, I mean, obviously, if that is the case, then yeah, we'll have a lot to discuss as far as that's concerned, because they don't have televised games very often. So that's going to be something that, you know, games are already 2.5 hours there. So what, you try to shrink them to 2, right? It kind of creates a new health risk almost in certain situations for them.
So I think for the – sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, basically, that answers the questions right there, like what to do about shortening the games, and that's to shorten media timeouts, shorten commercial breaks. I mean, I know rules with all that and stuff like that, yeah. But that kind of answers its own question right there, the fact that you're not seeing that in the D2 and the D3 ranks.
Yeah, I think, again, at the D2, D3 level, for me, it goes back to how many snaps per game. If that's mm-hmm. changed at all over the last 30 or 40 years, then maybe there are some rule changes, you know, because right. that gets to safety as much as time.
Sure.
But if the amount of plays, like in the NFL, the amount of plays have pretty much stayed the same for 60 years, mm-hmm. up and down, here and there. It's not that much different. So if the plays that Mary Harden Baylor are running in 2022 are about the same as they are in 1982, then this is not an issue for them. And maybe we should just skip over them in terms of like making these rule changes. But if they are playing, you know, 20-30% more snaps than they were 20-30 years ago, maybe that is something to look at also, because the offenses are changing and what we're putting on the defense changes as well. And at that level, they don't have 85 scholarships. And so, sure. you know, some of it's about safety as much as it is about time, even though I think the time window becomes the big conversation in this deal.
Yeah. So we will see this, if implemented, these rule changes, whichever one they pick, whatever 2, 3, all 4 they pick, it is planned to be implemented this fall, if anything gets passed. So this will be something that we'll be discussing and kind of keeping our eye on going forward. All right. Another piece of news before we get into our interview, as you most likely saw from the title of this episode with North Texas head coach Eric Morris, AAC. Dropped their schedule. Finally, we got a big look at all of that going on. I mean, Craven, immediate thoughts when you saw the AAC schedule from anywhere. It doesn't have to be North Texas, but just Rice, UTSA, anything like that.
Yeah, I kind of went team by team. You know, for North Texas, I think the non-conference, we already knew the non-conference schedule. And again, we knew who each team was going to play. We just didn't know kind of when. You know, I think North Texas has a really good kind of runway into the season. I think their mm-hmm. first 6, 7, 8 games set them up for success. The stretch run is going to be tough. They end UTSA, SMU, UAB are 3 out of their last 4 games. And so I think if you're Eric Morris and you know you got to play those teams, you'd rather play them late than early mm-hmm. just because you're a first year head coach and, sure. and maybe you know more about your team then. So I think that worked out as well as it could for North Texas. I challenge you to pick what the best home game is for an SMU football fan this year.
Oh man.
Let me just do yeah. this real quick.
Yeah.
La Tech, Charlotte, Prairie View, A&M, Tulsa, North Texas, Navy.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the answer is North Texas. Just like, you just go watch the rival, right?
Yeah, that doesn't care. SMU doesn't care about that as much as North Texas.
You and I can speak to that when we went to the TCU SMU game. That stadium was empty at halftime, and it was a close game.
Right. Yeah, that's fair.
They were out of water that day, though.
I'm saying there's nobody getting drawn to any of those other games in comparison, right? It's not a bad home schedule.
It's not a great home slate, and I can see why you'd want to get to the Pac-12 when you were asked to get season tickets with that going on. So, but on the good side of it, SMU doesn't play Tulane or UTSA. And I would imagine those three teams are arguably your, you know, favorites on paper going into the year. So that sets up pretty favorably for SMU. I think for UTSA, they get the bye week after non-conference, and that's big for the Roadrunners. They play another pretty tough first four games again this year. They got Tennessee, Army, Houston, three out of the first four out of the gate. So getting a bye right out of that, I think, is important for them. They play Tulane in the last game of the year. That could be a championship game decider. It could be one of those things where they play back-to-back weeks, the way that that goes, if those two teams are really good. And then finally for Rice, they got that random UConn non-conference game on October 7th. That kind of is weird, the way that the bye weeks work. But then they face a slate here at the end of October going to November. That's insane. October 28th, home to Tulane. November 4th, home to SMU. The next week, November 11th, at UTSA. Get bowl eligible before Halloween, or it might not happen. That's a very tough end of the road for Rice.
Yeah, one of the things that stood out to me was North Texas could very well be on the verge of bowl eligibility come mid-October and miss a bowl. Genuinely, because that for early slate is very favorable, right? FIU, La Tech, ACU, Navy, Temple. They could probably go in with one loss heading into Tulane, right? Yeah, and then Tulane, sense. Memphis, UTSA, SMU, Tulsa, and UAB.
That's tough.
That is insane to close the season. Now, granted, I would still probably bet them to flip maybe one of those 50-50 games and they get to six. But, you know, that's still a tough, tough stretch. Like you mentioned, luckily they'll be towards the end of the year. So, like, we'll likely see what that offense looks like with Chandler Rogers. And they'll probably be kind of fully they'll understand Eric Morris's system by then and be at least at their best possible form. But still, that's going to be insane to expect. SMU. What would you set that over under with being? Oh, actually, let me ask this. What would be a disappointment? Because this schedule sets up very, very favorably for Rhett Lashley's crew. What would be a disappointment to you?
I think eight games or fewer.
Yeah.
Like, they should be 9-3 or better. I mean, they should be playing in the AAC championship game. Like, they don't get Tulane, they don't get UTSA. Yeah. They have a pretty easy home schedule to where they should go undefeated at home. If they're decent on the road, they should be, you know, one or two loss in conference and right there for a conference championship game, because, you know, UTSA and Tulane have to play each other.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And UTSA gets Tulane at the end of the year. So that's going to be favorable for them. Definitely. I guess the only team that's kind of up in the air, as far as I'm concerned, is, like, this isn't in the state, but East Carolina. Cause, like, they're a team that improved a lot last year. So I don't know how to, like, gauge UTSA versus them. Right, SMU versus them, or North Texas doesn't get them, so that's beneficial for them. But still, that's a game where I look at UTSA schedules like they should be favored, but, like, I don't know. That was a tricky team that improved quite a bit last season as well. So that was some pretty interesting stuff that came out with the AAC conference dropping. I was talking to Matthew Bruni about it, and he was pretty nervous about UNT hitting the 6-win mark, but, you know, we kind of expected probably a little bit of a struggle in Eric Morris's first year. All right.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, we're just waiting on the Sun Belt.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, God, that's always been traditionally the last conference to
announce. They said by March 1st. So, you know, it's gotta be next week, I would imagine.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll hope. Anyway, speaking of North Texas, let's get to our interview. Mike Craven sat down with new North Texas head coach Eric Morris, of course, talking to him about why North Texas, things like that. Not as much football questions, but of course, getting our chance to really kind of just dive in depth into it. So let's get to that. Here is our interview with Eric Morris.
Here with North Texas head coach Eric Morris. I see you in your new office there in Denton, Texas. When you're setting up an office, what's kind of your go-to? What are the first couple things you need to do to get your office to where you're ready to work in it?
As you can tell, there's nothing here right now. I have a cup that somebody gifted me so kindly. I have a football that no telling how old that football is right there. So, unfortunately, all my stuff's in transit right now from Pullman, Washington. And so hopefully the next time we get on here and do a little podcast that this thing will be filled with cool memorabilia, with cool stuff from the community, maybe some past players' jerseys on the wall, some of our guys' pictures on the wall. So we're still in the process of getting everything worked out. Next time, hopefully it looks good. There's a bunch of people outside hanging new TVs in the offices right now. So under construction right now, get back. I'll get back to you on a later date of who has the prettiest office. I'd probably be last on the totem pole right now.
Is that just because of this, how busy it is when you hit the ground running these days? Like, there's not a month or two to kind of get adjusted and figure out the lay of the land with the transfer portal, the early signing period, the February signing period. Can you just talk to how busy it is for coaches and players right now in the calendar?
I'll be honest with you. I've had time to do it. You know, we've had some long weekends here recently. And so, you know, really the reason mine is like this right now is just simply because of logistics. You know, we're me getting my stuff all the way here. So I just sold my home in Pullman, should be closing on that here at the end of this week, and then purchased a home here. So it's not like, hey, let's take a couple hour road trip. Let's get all your stuff here. It's like, hey, let's ship it across the country. And so, although I got back from Pullman this weekend, the only thing that made it back was my golf clubs. I haven't enjoyed not being able to play golf at this time of year. It's 84 and beautiful outside. So, I thought golf clubs were more important than office decor right now. And so, I think it just depends on where you're at, what the situation is. I'd like to blame it on me being busy. I've had plenty of time to set my office up for me, being honest with you. Just, I don't have any things here to put in here. They're all in Pullman.
What's the handicap?
Oh, not good. love to play. I'm like those guys on all the, on the Twitter and TikTok and Instagram, where they're like always practicing their swing, and then they go out there and they look terrible. So unfortunately, I'm pretty good at most sports. You know, tomorrow we're going to have a basketball competition within the whole team. We got a 3-point shootout tomorrow. I take myself in that all day, any day. Football, still like my odds. And just didn't grow up playing golf, didn't pick it up until college. You know, I can shoot mid 80s by the end of the summer. By no stretch of the imagination, I'm going to sit here and say I'm a great golfer. I like to try to hit it way too hard.
Now, speaking of basketball, you played high school at Shallow Water. Y'all won a state title there. Your dad was your head coach. What was it like winning a state title with your dad? Where does that rank in terms of sports memories for you?
Yeah, at the top for me, just for personal, you know, I think that you know, it was his first state championship, his only state championship, Shallower's only state championship. And to win it in dramatic fashion, you know, to be able to hit a shot at the end to actually win it and capitalize that for my father, you know, put so many hours into it. You know, I can remember as a young child from kindergarten on, you know, mom would just send you over to the gym to hang out with dad for the rest of the afternoon and until we got home. And so, yeah, it's something that that I'll forever – remember as one of those special memories. Not only I think because I was able to do it and have, you know, something where I could hit the shot at the end, but also, you know, so that my family could enjoy it, and it's something that we enjoyed together. So I think we'll always have that special bond, my dad and I. You know, it's something that's special to have those. I still have my state championship ring in with all my bowl rings that I earned as a player, just because it's been that special to me.
How early on did you know you were going to follow in his footsteps as a coach? Was that pretty obvious to you as a little kid? Do you have any stories of kind of helping him with plays and helping him at practice and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I've always been pretty aggressive and pretty just uber competitive, I would say. You know, from a young age, I remember, you know, being in Little Dribblers, and my dad used to give me money every time I'd pass the ball when we were in Shallow Water. We'd dominate, you know, the other team so bad. And so he wasn't rewarding me for scoring points. He was rewarding me for passing the ball and getting my teammates involved. You know, something where I was just almost a gym rat, whatever sport it was. And, you know, we went in Shallow Water, I think going from football to basketball to baseball was something that you know, you just played them all and you did it to compete with your teammates and to compete with your classmates. And I think you had that sense of pride for the community around Shallow Water and winning as a community. Everybody kind of followed you. So I think that was something cool. Now, getting into the X's and O's part of it, I always had a love for sports and a love for competition. And I think that really once I got to college is really when I fell in love with the schematics part of it and being able to, you know, form relationships with different people from different backgrounds, different demographics, all walks of life. I think that was something that I really took interest to, you know, formed a lot of great friends. They're coming from all over the country. And so I think, you know, we had our first year at Texas Tech at Shallow Water, you know, a guy from Illinois of all places was someone that kind of stayed with me when we went on winter break and things. You know, we just drive 15 miles down the street and he'd stay at the house with me. My mom and dad would cook for a bunch of the receivers on the team. And so you got that kind of sense of pride with your other teammates. And so I think the relationship part of it started then. And then just having great coaches in college. I mean, look, my three position coaches were, you know, Sonny Dykes, Lincoln Riley, and Dana Holgerson. And so I think those are guys that are just mentors of mine that really poured into my life. And you know, I knew I wasn't the most gifted athlete out there. They're going to try to recruit me every year. You know, here I am, this little 5'8 guy from a small town that didn't have any just redeeming quality where I was like, holy smokes, you know, this guy's just a natural freak athlete out there. It's like, you know, I had to work for everything. And so I think I had to give myself a leg up. And so I took pride in learning the offense and knowing when to be, where to be, formed a great relationship with Graham Harrell. You know, anytime you're a receiver, you want the ball, form a good relationship with the quarterback. So hopefully he throws you the rock. You know, I'm in the huddle every play, like, hey, Graham, just do this, like throw it here when they do this. And so, yeah, I think all that. And then, you know, Mike Leach was such a huge influence in me throughout my college career. I think college is really when I was like, hey, you know, this is what I want to do. I want to be a football coach at this level. And but I think, you know, the competitive part of it, my dad being a coach was something that kind of got it. The idea started early, but it didn't really hit me till college where I said, hey, this is what I want to make a career out of.
Now, speaking of Mike Leach and those coaches you played for, kind of what's your first Mike Leach memory, whether it be a phone call, a visit, kind of what was your first interaction with him like?
Yeah, they always told me no for a long time. You know, I mean, I went to all the camps. I did all these things almost like I was begging them for a scholarship. And so, you know, basically, you know, at one point, I think I told them that, you know, they were recruiting a couple other guys for that last scholarship. And I told them to leave that scholarship in a room, lock the door, and I'd fist fight all the guys. Whoever came out with it gets the scholarship. And so I think Mike really, he liked that approach to it. You know, he knew that I was a tough guy. And Mike would probably tell you that, you know, all the guys that kind of in that slot category, me, Amendola, Wes Welker, you know, everybody always asks him, hey, how'd you find these guys? You know, how'd you recruit them? He's like, I didn't recruit one of those guys. They recruited me and they wanted to come here. They showed us somehow, some way, and had a kind of special circumstances in getting there. So, no, it's good. And finally, you know, I finally started getting recruited late. Phil Bennett started recruiting me at SMU, was bringing me down an official visit. And so I think that's where it kind of flipped the switch in Texas Tech. Got me on an official visit. They offered me when I was in a meeting with Coach Leach. He does his famous little card trick, you know, that when he offers people. And so, you know, he says, hey, if at the end of the card trick, you know, he does this whole rendition and only a fashion Mike Leach can. And then like, they're all cards are laid out. And he's like, if this whole pile is black and this whole pile is red, then you have a scholarship. And I'm sitting there like, oh, me and my mom and dad, like, I hope we didn't mess up on this card trick, right? And try to joke. Flips them over. They were, you know, I committed as fast as possible. So he couldn't, you know, rethink that thing. And you know, as a thing that he took a chance on me, and I was forever grateful and worked extremely hard to make him, proud.
Now, you mentioned all those coaches that you had at the wide receiver position. They're all head coaches now, while, you know, successful head coaches. I think 5 of the 13 head coaches in the state of Texas either played or coached for Mike Leach during that time at Texas Tech. We cover high school football here for a living, and you see the air raid all across the state at every single level. What made that offense so contagious, and why is it, you know, kind of the thing you see when you turn on the TV, not only on Saturday, but on Friday and on Sunday as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a sexy brand of football. I mean, I think people like seeing the ball thrown all over the yard. And then I think, you know, there's such a simplistic mindset to the way Leach did it. And I think that, you know, some of the smart coaches and players that coached for him and played for him, I think it almost drove them crazy a little bit that they were doing the same thing over and over, so repetitive. So I think that's why, you know, a bunch of them branched off. They wanted to coach, but they wanted to put their own spin on it. It's because, you know, Mike was so hard-headed and set in his ways that they're like, hey, I could do this a little bit better. Let me show you how. And so, you know, there's a lot of beauty in the simplicity of it. But at the same time, I think a bunch of those guys were so frustrated when they left that place because Mike was so simple. You know, us as players, you know, we were always – I remember scoring a touchdown one time against I think it was Oklahoma State. We had double slant on, and they were in a certain defense, and Graham said, hey, I'm going to signal double slant again next time, you know, run a slant and go, which, you know, we don't have that in the playbook. And so we did it. We scored a touchdown against Oklahoma State, and, of course, you know, we jog off to the sideline. Everyone's high-fiving, and Mike brings us over. He's like, what was that? And, so one of those cool moments where, you know, when you scored a touchdown, he obviously wasn't going to take you out. He probably ripped us pretty good after that. But, you know, I think we were so just eager to learn more, do more, and we had so much success at the same time. But, you know, I think everybody's kind of adapted to it, you know, the old school air raid, and, you know, they found out ways to stop. And I think back in the day when Mike first started, you know, nobody was throwing the ball like that. So nobody really had an answer for it. And I think it just spread like wildfire, especially over, you know, the Big 12. And then people slowly, you know, I think you're in the second round of it now where everybody kind of went against it. And now they're going back to, you know, heavy tight ends and running the football a little bit more with the Baylors and Oklahoma States and adding a new dynamic to it. But yeah, I think, you know, the simplistic approach to it has always been something that's caught a lot of people's eyes. And but then, again, I think that the really good ones nowadays have added their own little flair to it and new things that are helping, you know, take it to the next level.
You became a head coach for the first time in 2018 at Incarnate Word. What did you learn from that experience as a head coach that you're able to kind of, I don't know, maybe fast forward the process a little bit more at North Texas since you've done it before?
I think the better question is what I didn't learn from being a head coach. I don't think you're ever ready to be a head coach until you're thrown into the fire. Obviously, that was a place I think that, you know, didn't have any history of football. Had no momentum whatsoever. You know, if you probably rank the Division I jobs in Texas from first to last, when I took it, it'd probably be last at that time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've always prided myself in doing things that people say can't be done. And so, you know, that was a fun place to kind of go cut your teeth. I made plenty of mistakes at Incarnate Word, trust me. And so, you know, I think it helped me here. You know, the timing of my hire, we're so close, you know, a day or two from signing day. And I think, you know, when I went back on the first time as a head coach, I made a lot of mistakes because I went too fast on things. And whether that was recruiting, whether that was hiring people, whether that was, you know, whatever I was doing. And so that allowed me to say, hey, that making the right hires is more important to take my time than to rush in this and get somebody that's not going to believe in the same things I believe in or fit into our culture. And then recruiting, same thing. I mean, there's plenty of guys throughout, you know, the state of Texas, especially that we can go recruit late here that are overlooked because of the transfer portal right now. So I think to take your time, you know, not have knee-jerk reactions. To really be able to listen to your surrounding people. I think, you know, I take great pride in the people that I hired, and I'm not a micromanager, so let these guys do their jobs and to ask them for their input. You know, I think, you know, I have a bunch of guys that have head coaching experience on my staff right now, and I'm not too proud to go ask them and say, hey, I don't know the answer on this. And you know, what have you seen? What have your, you know, past situations look like? And so, so yeah, a ton of mistakes in Incarnate Word, but at the end of the day, you know, I was able to learn how to do a bunch of things on the fly. I wasn't under the magnifying glass all the time, so to speak. And you know, I mean, that was a win-win situation for me. You know, we start winning some games, and all of a sudden, you know, win a conference championship our first year, and you start turning a lot of heads. Like, what are those guys doing over there? And so, so yeah, it definitely wasn't me. I hired a lot of great people. That were able to help me get there. We recruited a lot of great kids that played their tails off for us and helped us change that culture. So, so yeah, ton of things I learned and I was able to reflect on as taking this job.
How in the world did Cam Ward kind of just go under the radar so much in that recruiting process? Because I mean, he's a superstar, right? He played really well for y'all, then transferred to Washington State. In today's world with social media and Huddle and everything like that, how often do players like that still kind of fall through the cracks?
Yeah, more than what you'd think. You know, I think that nowadays, you know, a bunch of these coaches want to go on these rankings from outside sources now, and as opposed to putting in the homework and really going and evaluating and figuring out, you know, not only the skill sets that kids have, but what they can become. You know, I think there's this thing where, you know, kids are overdeveloped in the state of Texas. And, you know, so you have a kid that's from, you know, way down in West Columbia that plays every sport, that doesn't go to a quarterback trainer, that was a little bit, you know, not, he was in a wing T offense, so really wasn't able to showcase his skill set. So I just think, and then there's the lost art of kids developing late nowadays. You know, there's a bunch of great seniors that kind of develop late, and you have to continue to evaluate senior tape. And so, I mean, no secret. I mean, it's the same thing on a different scope, though, is why Patrick Mahomes went to Texas Tech and nobody else in the state of Texas wanted Patrick Mahomes, who's the greatest football player in the whole entire world right now, I guess. And so, I think there's so many levels to it. You know, obviously there's a bunch of quarterbacks that are really good in the state of Texas. There's going to be one or two that get overlooked every single year, and you're like, how the heck did he get out of here? And so we're going to have to continue to do a good job here, especially even at this level in the group of five, and continue to evaluate senior film, get these guys to come here to camps. And, you know, there'll be guys here and there that slip through the cracks.
Now, your name popped up with a decent amount of jobs this cycle. What made North Texas the right fit for you? And what gives you, hope or belief that, you know, y'all can be one of the top G5 programs in the nation with the expanded playoff and kind of the opportunities in front of you?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, just our administration. I mean, we have an athletic director here that I think I completely jive with. I mean, a guy that's from West Texas, a small town in West Texas, we're kind of cut from the same cloth as being out there. He was a guy that was from Lockney, Texas, and then went on to have a great basketball career at ACU, staying there kind of in the West Texas thumbprint. You know, I think we'd both, you know, cut our teeth in the Southland Conference. We've been used to you know, trying to elevate a program with not a ton of resources and find ways to be creative to make those things happen. And I think this West Texas people are genuine people that, you know, it's easy for me to go down and not have a meeting set up, sit down and hey, let's talk about the problems that are going on. How are we going to find solutions to this? And that was one thing, you know, talking to Jared Mosley was he understood that, you know, the trajectory of this place right now, I think, is really good. I mean, they've worked really hard to put them in a situation where they're moving into the American Conference next year, where they've, you know, built some great facilities around here. But at the same time, he knew we still had work to do to get to the top. And I've always been a guy that's been a problem solver. You know, I think that's what I love to do. That's kind of my mission and goals in life is not to look at our problems, you know, and be scared away, but hey, let's find solutions to the different problems, both for our student athletes and for our program. And so, I think first and foremost, just the relationship piece that I have and the compatibility that I have with my boss.
Spring practice is sneaking up on us, as crazy as that sounds. Kind of what are the goals for the first spring practice as a head coach? How much can you get in? How much of it is about scheme? How much of it is about just figuring out your players?
Yeah, I think to just be organized and make it look like an actual football plays are being run on both sides out there. You know, I think this day and age with the new rules of college football and allowing us to actually spend some time in the meeting room with them now, you know, get this 8-hour a week little period that we can have with the guys. And now, you know, so we're plucking 30 minutes here, 30 minutes there nowadays to actually go over what we're looking for in film, to actually go over terminology. And so I think those things are so helpful, is actually being able to go out there and know what the guys are doing on day one, opposed to, you know, we're looking at, you know, 10 or 15 years ago where you're walking out and it's literally the first time that you've heard some of these play calls, that you've been in a huddle, that you've seen it on tape. So I think the rules now allow you to kind of jump ahead on some of that stuff. And then too, I think we have a bunch of great kids around here. I think, you know, the culture in our locker room has been good as far as, you know, I come up here in the afternoons and you walk down the hallways and we have, you know, voluntarily guys sitting in with coaches, you know, wanting to learn more. They're eager to kind of figure things out right now. And so, so yeah, I mean, I think right now you really lean on your strength and conditioning coach, who's a guy I'm really familiar with, and Coach Keggins, who's worked, you know, with Coach Riley for the last 8 or 9 years. And then before that, you know, we were teammates together at Texas Tech. So really understands kind of what we're looking for as far as what we need once we get out there on the practice field and how it's going to be structured and what kind of shape they need to be in. And so really leaning into him right now as far as getting them bigger, faster, stronger, and in shape to handle what we're going to put on them physically. And then mentally, that's our job as coaches is to kind of, you know, try to bring those guys along and just get a day better. You know, I think that the progress through spring is something that you're going to look at from day one all the way to 15, you know, how much progress will we make, were we able to make during the course of those 15 practices.
And then lastly, the American conference schedule came out today. As a coach, how much do you kind of look at that and start thinking about things, or is that just so far down the road that it doesn't even really matter to you right now?
Yeah. I mean, my wife's interested in it more than I am. You know, she's trying to plan all the, you know, planning. When's the wives trip? You know, I've had more questions from my wife this morning than anybody else on kind of who we're playing, where we're playing, all those things. Just a great conference. You're going to have to play them all at some point, you know, and so, you know, when you look at it and you're kind of, you know, got a bunch of games that are important to this school kind of in the latter half of it, as far as, you know, playing the SMUs and the UTSAs and some of those guys that are closer to home. That'll be some of those in-state games that I know people take a great pride in around here. And so, but other than that, you know, I think that I'm happy with the way it landed for us. You know, obviously, you know, to be able to play the competition level that we're about to move up a conference and go against the UABs and the Tulsas and, you know, the SMUs, Memphises, UTSA. It's like, you know, there's not a week off in the schedule. And so I was more, you know, focused on, hey, who's going to be first? You know, who's our first conference game? And they're like, oh, here you go. You go play the triple option up north the first game. I'm like, that's perfect. And so, I think that obviously, you know, people can get into this scheduling thing on, you know, we got jipped or this team has a better, you know, run than we do. Their bye's in a better place than I do. But at the end of the day, I've always been a coach that, hey, we're going to have to play them all anyways. Like we're going to have to beat them all if we want to get to where we want to go and win a championship. So that stuff's out of our control. I don't spend a lot of time on worrying about things I can't control. I'd rather start figuring out how we can score a couple points against all these great opponents and maybe hold them to not very many touchdowns. And so, but our work will be cut out with us for us this year. Just a lot of quality opponents.
All right, Coach, we really appreciate the time. And when you do get those boxes in there, make sure you make Taylor pack them up for you to get them up there.
I'm going to send you a picture that way you can look at it and know that, hey, Coach Morris actually has a real office. I need some of those. You have the little soccer scarves in the background, yeah. All kinds of stuff.
Old credentials and stuff like that. So, you know, you got to make your workspace happy.
I'll be there at some point. So thanks, Mike. I appreciate you.
Thanks again to North Texas head coach Eric Morris for hopping on with us. Craven, before we get into these Texas 10s, a couple articles that you put out already about Eric Morris a little bit. You know, I remember you saw the Texas State game where they beat, where UIW beat Texas State. You know, after talking with them, after taking the North Texas job, do you think you've seen a little bit of a, I don't want to say growth necessarily, but have you sensed any difference in him at all from taking a year to go be an OC somewhere at D1 or to FBS level to now taking his second head coaching job back in the head seat?
What I've always loved about Eric Morris is he straddles that line between cocky and confident. Mm. You know, he kind of talks about, you know, he was like, we're going to have a basketball competition tomorrow. I'm taking me. You know, like, you know, he mentioned how he got a scholarship offer from Texas Tech. He said he told Mike Leach, you know, take anybody else that's competing for the scholarship offer, lock it in a room, and I'll fist fight anybody who wants it, and I'm going to get that scholarship offer, right? Like, he has always been that guy, and he did it at Incarnate Word. He took the underdog job at Incarnate Word. That job was like Lamar, right? I mean, he said it.
I was about to say, for at the time, Incarnate Word hiring the Texas Tech offensive coordinator is insane.
Yeah, it wasn't a good job. Like, yeah. Now Incarnate Word is rolling, and like you get to be a head coach at the FBS level if you do your time there or whatever. Like, you know, but it wasn't true then. That was a nothing program. And, you know, being an undersized 5'9", 4A player from shallow water Texas, he's kind of always had that chip on his shoulder, and he doesn't do it in like an in-your-face way. It's this kind of quiet smile in your face as he beat you in something, kind of confidence. And I think that's going to work well at North Texas. I think that's the perfect demeanor you need for these G5 jobs. I think Jeff Traylor's built a similar way. Mike Bloomgren's built a similar way. I think those guys are tough dudes who are kind of used to working for what they get. And I think that works there at that level. So I think when I talked to him, that's always the thing that stood out to me back in Incarnate Word or any time in between then. He's not cocky about it. He's not brash about it. But when you start talking to him about football and athletics, like, he is very confident and that he can get the job done, and history suggests that he's done it everywhere he stopped. So why would that, you know, not be true and didn't?
Sure, 100%. All right, let's get to a little bit of a transition. Speaking of North Texas, you made some new friends this week on Twitter. Let's get to the Texas 10s article. Okay, so if you're listening to this, quarterback, running back, and wide receiver are up right now. Or sorry, wide receiver will be up Thursday.
Tomorrow.
Yeah, Thursday. Quarterbacks and running backs are up. Of course, Mike Craven ranking the returning players coming in, or just the players coming into the position, early look before spring camp starts. Quarterback dropped, and Craven made some friends. North Texas was very, very, very noticing that Chandler Rogers was on an honorable mentions list. Again, go check out the article. I'll just give away the first place, Frank Harris. I don't think anybody could really debate that. For the full rankings, again, go check out the piece. But let's just get it right out of the way. You know, explain your reasoning, because I don't have a problem with it, right? But explain your reasoning why Chandler Rogers perhaps wasn't on the top 10.
I think once you get past number 7, Blake Shapen at Baylor, this thing opens up. The final three were Chandler Morris at TCU, who beat out Max Duggan, by the way, last offseason. So if Sonny Dykes Garrett Riley are confident in Chandler Morris's ability, me as a simpleton is going to be as well. Sure. JT Daniels, I mean, he's played Power 5 football, a former 5-star recruit. Like, he's going to be like, I know more about him, right, than I do about Chandler Rogers or Malik Hornsby. I think once you get to the Malik Hornsby, Chandler Rogers discussion, it's a flip of the coin in the air. I have no beef with anybody thinking that Chandler Rogers should be at 10. I took Hornsby because he's just so freaky speed-wise. Like, I know he does a thing that most people can't do. And I know in that G.J. Kinney, Mac Leftwich offense, it will work. And it has worked in the past. So I've seen a blueprint from it last year in Lindsey Scott, winning the Walter Payton Award as the top player in FCS. And he's coming down from the SEC, right? He's played against SEC defenses in the best division in college football. He's going to go down to the Sun Belt. That's going to be, you know, an easier transition than going from the Sun Belt to the American for a first-year head coach. You were decent in the Sun Belt, but right, it's not like Chandler Rogers was a first-team all-conference Sun Belt guy who led a team to a championship. Louisiana Monroe was 4-8. You know, like, they weren't very good. And so I just think there's so many question marks in the air. Maybe this is some bias because I know Malik Hornsby's game a little bit more, and I covered him more when he was in high school as a big-time recruit. But again, I have no problem with North Texas fans thinking that, you know, Rogers should be there at number 10 or even, you know, 8 or 9. The ones who are saying that he's like a top 5 quarterback in the state, I mean, that's just being a fan, right? I mean, he may end up being that, right? Like, Max Duggan was the runner-up in the Heisman. Like, we have no idea what's going to happen. But on paper, just looking at it, you can't put him above a lot of these other quarterbacks based on talent or just based on where they've played, right? Like, Connor Wigman hasn't played a lot of football, but he's 8 touchdowns, 0 interceptions against SEC competition. He's a 5-star recruit, right? Like, I'm going to bet on that every single day of the week over, you know, a Monroe transfer that we still don't know how he will transition into this offense or not.
No, 100%. I, as somebody who paid, you know, obviously I pay attention to the Sun Belt with Texas State. And so I knew he was a very capable quarterback, right? I knew he was probably very likely better than UL Monroe. That team wasn't very good this year. He was one of their bright spots, but it is a step up, right? His QBR was very fine, right? It was a lot of numbers that I don't say empty stats is an awful term. I'm not going to use that, but it was very much like this guy's clearly more talented than his supporting cast. And so he's clearly helped. And again, that's a credit to him. So maybe, yes, he could step up to this level and this is the level he should be playing at. And then he ends up being finishing the year. You know, we do this list again and he's eighth or fifth or whatever. But sure. As of right now, yeah, sure. I think that there was a lot to still question about it. Now, again, like you admit, we don't know a lot about what Malik Hornsby will do, but we do know one, he was very close to KJ Jefferson in that Arkansas battle, in that quarterback battle, right? KJ Jefferson got hurt a couple times. They had to put Malik Hornsby in, looked pretty good. We know him from his Fort Bend Marshall days. You do know he was a very, very, very highly touted recruit, and he's going down a level, right? He's going down to that level to where we could maybe have an easier time projecting him being kind of a game breaker. So, I don't know. Besides that one, was there any other ranking that you kind of had an issue with or where you had kind of struggled to kind of place them here?
Yeah, I honestly think the whole middle of it was pretty tough, right? Like, because it's a lot of projection this year.
It's a lot of turning the page.
It's a lot of projection. It's a lot of young guys who kind of got their feet wet last year, but weren't really the guys yet. You know, Connor Wegman, Preston Stone, Chandler Morris, Donovan Smith, even, you know, going into Houston where he's going to be the dude now. Mm-hmm. How do you rank those guys? I have no idea. Right. Yeah. And so, like, I think for me, the number one was the easiest. And then it felt like Quinn Ewers, Tyler Shuck are right there at 2-3, just because I've seen them do it more at you know, the big time level, quote unquote. But then 4-7 was like, I don't know. It's pick your poison, right? It's dealer's choice. That's how I phrased it. When we put it out there on social media, because it's what you value. Some of those guys have more experience. Some of those guys have more production. Some of those guys have more upside. Which one do you pick, you know? And so it's a subjective list. It's February. It's meant to be a talking point. And I'd imagine when we look back on this thing in December, just like last year, there's a little bit of egg on my face.
Yeah. Looking on to running backs a little bit, I think it's a little bit more set. There was some projection there, right? But I think towards the end there, but honestly, I'm looking at it right now, 1-8, I'd say first is Richard Reese, by the way, from Baylor. I don't think there was much debate there. 1-8, I feel like it's those names are off right. And I think it was just like getting the order correctly. There's not as much projection, right? Maybe you have a Jonathan Brooks who you're projecting on a little bit, but from what we saw in the little flashes she showed, it's hard. One, it's hard to punch into a rotation of Bijan and Roshan Johnson. But the fact that he got the highlights he did, 5 touchdowns out of that group is pretty damn good. So I would say, yeah, I'd be okay with him projecting him a little bit. But for the most part, I'd say those 8 names, if we're being honest, are pretty set in stone.
Yeah, I mean, I think Richard Reese was one. For me, the toughest thing was like, where do we put Alton McCaskill?
Sure. Yeah. Cause it's like we trying to remember 2 years ago or a year ago, I guess we should say.
He scored 18 touchdowns as a true freshman and set a rushing record for Houston in terms of yards, touchdowns, overall touchdowns, was great out of the backfield, was incredible at 18 years old. He missed last year for people who don't know. He tore his ACL in spring practice about a month from now. It'll be a year since he had that injury. And so, you know, having him back, where do you put him in that pecking order? Because going into last year, if he doesn't get injured in the spring, he's in our, you know, all Texas team, right? Like he was up next. Like, but after Bijan, after Devon Achane, Alton McCaskill was right there in that conversation of the next group of running backs. So where does he, you know, how does he come back from the injury? What does he look like moving into the Big 12 without Clayton Tune? He's going to have to be the focal point of this offense. You bring in Donovan Smith. Those two can really give you a 1-2 combination in the run game back there. It's going to be a different looking offense for Houston next year. So that was an interesting thing to me. Kavarian Barnes, you know, Ayo Adeyi, like where do you put those guys? How do they stack up against each other? You know, North Texas has been so good running the football over the last couple of years. What does that look like with Eric Morris? Do they kind of keep those same principles? They're losing a lot of offensive linemen at both of those schools. So what does that run game look like? You know, anybody who's listened to this podcast know I'm more of a offensive line dictates your running success more than running backs. And so how does that happen this year? But yeah, you get to the bottom of the list and you're guessing, you know, like Kamar Wheaton, we think it's pretty good. right? You know, Amari Daniels, you know, we think is pretty good, but you know, he only got 36 touches last year. That's how much they gave Devon Achane the ball, you know, in College Station. Like, he got all of the carries. And so, yeah, you get past those first six or seven guys and you're starting to kind of project. And, you know, then there's crowded backfields, right? Like, we put Jonathan Brooks in there, but if somebody told me right now, Cedric Baxter's the guy by, you know, mid-October and Jonathan Brooks is a reserve player, I'm believing him. Like, that's how good Cedric Baxter is.
Or you know, Jadon Blue, he put on insane weight and he's ready to go, you know?
I mean, at A&M, Reuben Owens comes in there and just takes that job. Like, I'm not surprised, right? At SMU, if LJ Johnson transfers in there and takes over from Kamar Wheaton, I'm not surprised. And so I think running back can be the toughest place to project these days because there's so few places where you just have that one dude, right? It's more of a stable, more of a committee, more about offensive line and what your coach wants to do. And so it can be tough to really parse who is the better talents and who is just getting more opportunities to be talented.
Oh yeah, 100%. So like I mentioned, those two are up right now on textfootball.com. Wide receiver will be dropping Thursday if you're listening.
I'm struggling on the top three wide receiver deal.
I've taken a peek on it. It's tough. It is very tough.
Because I think there's three guys that are in the conversation.
Sure, 100%.
Zachary Franklin at UTSA.
Xavier Worthy
at Texas. Evan Stewart at Texas A&M.
Yeah. And so, like, the debate of if, of course, last year was Xavier Worthy or Tank Dell, right? Whichever.
It
was
kind of going like into the year. Rashee Rice.
Yeah, sure. But, okay, Xavier Worthy clearly, I don't want to say took a step back, but he was very much not on the same page as his quarterback.
He didn't take the step forward we thought he was going to take. Right. He had some
high profile drops and him and Quinn Ewers just did not get on the same page. So like, okay, how much do you take away from, is he a worse player, right? Necessarily. Penalize him a little bit for reward Zachary Franklin who had a stellar season.
And if Evan Stewart played in a Will Stein offense with like a 6-year quarterback starting or like what would his numbers look like?
I was about to say he had 650 yards with like 27 different quarterbacks and like one of them was capable of like probably being the starter. So it was nuts. And as a true freshman. So it's going to be crazy. I've seen the list so far and it's looking pretty interesting. We're going to get some discussion on that one probably.
Go ahead.
May get more hate if you put Zachary Franklin at number one too.
I don't think there's an argument against it.
I would pick Zachary Franklin. I mean, going into this year, he's got the best quarterback.
He had the best production, in my opinion, last year. Like, I think this is, I don't know. We'll see. Because to be honest, I think Texas fans will have a hard time arguing Worthy not being number, or have a hard time arguing Worthy being number one off of last year, right? Yeah. I think they would look at it and say, yeah, you're right. He took a little bit of a step back because they're disappointed in him.
I mean, Zachary Franklin had 94 catches for 1,136 yards and 15 touchdowns.
Yeah.
Worthy and Stewart combined for 11.
Yeah.
Like,
and
Zachary Franklin is freaking good. And if he transferred to Ole Miss, like, he would be talked about as one of the best wide receivers in the nation, but he's at UTSA. And so we don't do that. Same thing what happened with Jacob Cowing at UTEP.
I was about to say, he was a good Jacob Cowing example. I mean,
Zachary Franklin is an NFL player. Like, that is a guy. That is not just some G5 dude collecting stats or whatever. That is a dude. Joshua Cephas, also a dude. JT Clark, also a guy. Like, and so, yeah, it's just, like I said earlier, it's just a hard one because I think if I'm going potential, I'm taking Evan Stewart, number one.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
If I'm going production, I'm taking Zachary Franklin, number one. But if I'm going upside in the offense that he exists in, I think I'm taking Xavier Worthy, number one. And so it's just a hard thing at the top. And another part of it, I just think I'm really all in on A&M's offense this year. I mean, somebody's going to have to help me.
Right. From this. To reel it back in.
Reel me back in. But Evan Stewart, Anaya Smith is coming back.
Mm-hmm. That's a massive get.
Iwan Smith just transferred in from UTEP after being in the top 10 wide receiver in the nation productive-wise. Mm-hmm. Moose Muhammad is freaking awesome.
I was about to say, Moose Muhammad as a number 2/3, that is insane.
And if JT Sanders didn't play tight end at Texas,
Donovan Green would be the best tight end in this freaking state.
Yeah.
And so, like, if Connor Wegman is any good, and if Bobby Petrino can call plays from this decade, and that offensive line blocks anybody, like, my Lord, like, Texas A&M, like, all of a sudden, they're going to go from a laughingstock offense to, like, look at all these weapons. And so, I think I've talked myself into Texas, and I think I've talked myself into Texas A&M, which means I've fully been indoctored into the Dave Campbell's Texas football. Like, I'm all in. Like, I'm as homerish as Homer can get in this.
The mothership brands, you're just right. All in right, right now. Yeah.
Right.
All right. Well, like I said, that'll drop Thursday morning, so we'll definitely get that one out, and hopefully you guys can go check it as well. Yeah, that'll do it for us. By the way, go check out a lot of Greg Powers' stuff right now. He just put out this week his top 10 FBS Instant Impact Freshmen for 2023. He went through and looked at some first-year guys. By the way, that's not all his projection either. That's talking around a little bit, right?
Sources. So
if you want a hint of maybe who your school is looking at pretty early to start right away, make a pretty big impact, go check out that piece. The other one is, of course, is the six most offered 2024s already. That just went up today on Wednesday. And yeah, be sure to keep an eye out for Corey's piece as well on D3 coaches and their opinions on the potential rules changes coming to college football. That'll do it for us. We have now caught back up. We've interviewed 12 of the 13 FBS head coaches, thanks to both GJ Kinney and Eric Morris. Jimbo Fisher, you are once again back to being the only one within 2 weeks. Within 2 weeks, you're back to being the only one. So please jump on with us. And as always, go Rutgers.